Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I wrote this talk some years ago when I worked in the University of Sydney in Australia, their Catholic chaplaincy. And one of the things that kind of was, I loved that job, it was fantastic, but one of the things that kind of made me question is, it was such a beautiful country with like gorgeous nature, kind of like here, you're close to the water, you got this really beautiful place. And really, everybody had what they needed for living. Like, it's not a country that lacks resources. And people were friendly. It was a great place to live in many ways. And yet, there was a lot of depression among the young, even hopelessness, I would say. And so I actually, this talk came out of a desire of my heart to actually explore what are some of the ways that we might be, even inadvertently, even not aware of how we've fallen into just surviving when we were actually meant to thrive. And it actually is rooted in my favorite passage of scripture, which is Jesus' kind of own self-statement of his mission. It's John 10:10. I'm terrible at memorizing numbers, so I like that it's John 10:10. When Jesus says, "I came that you might have life and have it to the full." You know, and if you just paused on that phrase, like, and if you just said, literally thought about it right now, do I feel like I'm living life to the full? Like, because I think that Jesus said this, so it's what he wanted us to have. Okay? But if we kind of paused and said, how does our world, our culture kind of look at living life to the full? I think there's a kind of myth in our culture that the more I go deeply into my faith, the less life I'll have. Like, because if I were to seriously follow Christ, there would be things I would have to leave aside, right? And somehow I wouldn't be like just experiencing the fullness of life. And yet, Christ said that his very mission was that we might have life to the full. So there's got to be something that's kind of misguided in that way of looking at things. And I know it because at different stages of my own life where I was going to go deeper in my own faith, and certainly when I pursued my religious vocation, there were people who were like, why would you do something like that? Like, you would have less life. And yet, if you look at people who go all in their faith, like, I grew up in the era of Mother Teresa and John Paul II. When I was a child, they were still living. And like, when I looked at them, did I see someone who was living less or someone who was living more? And so I guess in a way that encouraged me to think about this. But I think, like, be honest with yourself as you listen to this talk. Like, because probably all of us get kind of caught up in certain ways of thinking and being that might make us kind of feel like we're more like surviving. Kind of an easy question is, when you wake up in the morning, do you feel like excited that it's like another day you get to like enjoy life? Or do you feel like, I just wish I could hit the eternal snooze button, right? Are you like just not ready for it? At the end of a day, do you kind of just fall exhausted into bed? Or do you kind of like look back at your day, even briefly, and kind of think, wow, this was a day full of blessing. Like, there were so many like encounters, so many experiences that, you know, really changed things. So do you really believe that Jesus came that you might have life and have it to the full? And do you think that that describes the average day of your life? And I'm going to walk with you through a few famous thinkers, some of whom I really like their thoughts, some of whom it wouldn't be my favorite, but who asked good questions and or made good observations, okay? So the famous philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, a French existentialist, made this observation. He said, everything has been figured out except how to live. It's an interesting statement. Everything has been figured out except how to live. I think on university campuses, this is even more apparent than in some places. We all go to lots of lectures, and we listen to facts, figures, ideas, ideologies, and I think we can literally step back and say, is there wisdom in this? Like, I'm learning a lot of things, but is it really helping me know how to live? A reflection of the struggle to find meaning in life can be seen in the great challenge of a sort of restless anxiety that is not only in the elderly, but really also very much in young people. And I think you know, if I'm a kind of a little bit hesitant to read just statistics and studies because I'm not always sure what they're who they're actually asking, but there are a lot of studies that say there's kind of an epidemic of loneliness and lack of meaningfulness in, especially in the young, which is a little bit counterintuitive, right? Because youth is supposed to be a time of your maximum like energy and enthusiasm and desire to live and embrace life. So I think if we're seeing this, and maybe in one of its most dramatic forms, in all the many forms of addiction in our culture. And I'm not talking just about the obvious addictions to certain substances, but even addictions to technology, even addictions to certain patterns or ways of behavior that are really genuinely like keeping us in their power instead of we have power over them. When I reflect on that, I think it seems to me that would reflect a crisis in fullness of life. Because I would argue that we don't try to escape a reality that we've embraced. I want to repeat that. We don't try to escape a reality that we've embraced. And so if you don't like the real world, if you have to live in a fantasy world, whether it's binging Netflix, whether it's playing video games all day, whether it's like creating whatever virtual pseudo reality you create, is it because the reality that you're living in is so unmeaningful to you, so unfulfilling, that you feel like you have to have this other? So in order to look at this, I think we need to look at kind of some, what are some of the causes of the problem? And hopefully I can present to you some pretty meaningful ideas about what might be some of the cures of this crisis. So I propose a perhaps surprising, but hopefully thought-provoking consideration based in some of the great writers that I'm going to share some of their thoughts with you to what might be some of the key obstacles to living life to the full, because I think we all want that, okay? But what might be the obstacles? And the three I'm going to consider with you are suffering, fatigue, and boredom, okay? I'll explain why as we go. I think suffering can be a stumbling block, and it's really not helpful to compare your suffering with somebody else's, because sometimes people are in a place where they feel pain, where they're suffering in some way, whether it's physically, emotionally, spiritually, and people are like, but there are other people experiencing so much bigger sufferings, and they try to like minimize or negate that experience of the suffering. But the fact is, if you're the one subjectively experiencing something that hurts, it's not like you're using it as a baseline in comparison to all these other people. You are suffering. And I think we all grapple at some stage in our lives, and maybe a lot, with the inevitable question of, if there were an all good and all-powerful God, why would he allow so much suffering not only in the world around us but in our personal lives? In fact, this year my community, we do community-wide studies together. We read something and we meet monthly to discuss it, and this year we're doing Augustine's Confessions, and it was for Saint Augustine of Hippo. It was one of his biggest challenges, was finding the philosophical way to grapple with suffering, with evil, because he was like, you know, he fell into the Manichaean debate because he thought it seemed like there was like a source of all that's dark and evil and a source of everything that's light and good, and that they're in this constant warfare. And so Manichaeism was very appealing to him, but it was kind of a seismic shift in his mind and heart when he realized that evil is not a thing in itself, it's the lack of the good that should be there, a privation of being, the philosophers would say, right? So, but I think he is representative of so many people in our contemporary culture who say, you know, if you think God is part of the equation of living a life to the full, why would a good God let there be so much personal and communal suffering? Well, a man who really pondered this question, not in the speculative so much as in the practical, his name was Viktor Frankl. He was an accomplished doctor of neurology and psychiatry. He was not only deported to the Nazi concentration camps where forced labor nearly broke his mind and body, but in those very camps, he lost his mother, his father, his brother, and his wife. For all the physical and mental tortures to which people were subjected in those camps, Frankl, looking back at it and writing in his very famous book, Man's Search for Meaning, he concluded it was not suffering itself, but lack of meaning that led people to despair. And I think you could actually think about this in your own life's journey and in the journey of the people that you know and love. Is it suffering itself that leads us to despair, to give up, to feel like we can't go on? Or is it that you can't find any meaning in that? And he thought it was that you can't find any meaning in that. Despite the almost unspeakable suffering that he endured, he did not succumb to despair.
Gordon Allport, a professor of psychology from Harvard University, asked this question: how could he, Viktor Frankl, every possession lost, every value destroyed, suffering from hunger, cold, brutality, hourly expecting extermination, how could he find life worth preserving? The answer that Frankl discovered is what he records in Man's Search for Meaning. As he describes the initial arrival at the camp with the routine stripping of all possessions, all clothing, the substitution of one's name with a number, even the shaving of their whole bodies, Frankl reflects, we knew we had nothing to lose except our ridiculously naked lives. He writes in his writing reflections on this that nearly everyone was tempted to give up completely. And he says, this was born of the hopelessness of the situation, the constant danger of death looming over us daily and hourly, and the closeness of death suffered by many of the others. Yet even in what could arguably be called the living hell of these camps, Frankl witnessed and experienced the resilience of the human spirit. He noted that the key to survival was not so much in physical strength as in spiritual freedom. He reflects, in spite of all the enforced physical and mental primitiveness of the life in a concentration camp, it was possible for the spiritual life to deepen. He writes, sensitive people who were used to a rich intellectual life may have suffered much pain, especially since they were often of a delicate constitution. Their bodies were often weaker. But the damage to their inner selves was less. They were able to retreat from the terrible surroundings to a life of inner riches and spiritual freedom. Among the reminders that life could and does have a deep meaning, even in those camps, were the smallest signs of beauty, truth, and goodness. And I would argue that a life that is seeking and enjoying what is beautiful, true, and good will always be one in which there is meaning. Frankl recounts moments of glimpsing a sunset or seeing a patch of the starry sky, of a mercy of a guard who let him rest even just a moment without continuing to beat him, of hearing one distant song played on a violin instead of the endless shouting. These became reminders of his humanity and his dignity. Surprisingly, the prisoners even managed to formulate jokes and comedy skits. Can you imagine they put on comedy skits in concentration camps? But they did, okay? Reflecting on this, Frankl muses that the attempt to develop a sense of humor and to see things in a humorous light is some kind of trick learned while mastering the art of living. Among the most transcendent experiences for Frankl was the memory of his wife and the love they shared. Barely able to walk amid the shouting and beating of the guards, he began to think of his wife. And then he wrote, "It was then that I grasped the meaning of the greatest secret that human poetry and human thought and belief have to impart. The salvation of man is through love and in love." And I agree with Frankl 100%. What is the most meaningful thing in this world and in the world to come? Love. Based on his own experiences in the life of the camp, Frankl traced three stages of his, what he calls the response to extreme suffering. The first is horror, which he says is an instinctive repugnance to inhumanity, that when you first are confronted with very serious suffering, your own or somebody else's, it can be something you see in the media, it can be something you witness, something you've experienced, you have this repugnance. It's like, it's inhuman, you don't like it. But he says that if you keep being exposed to serious suffering, you move into a second phase of apathy, the development of an attitude of not caring as a form of self-defense. So we don't not care is a normal human response. It's not a normal human response to suffering to not care, right? But sometimes we feel so powerless in the face of suffering, our own or another's, that this is a kind of self-defense-y things to become apathetic. And thirdly, what he calls a loss of value, where a person literally seems to lose any sense of clinging to what is good, true, and beautiful. Writing of the person pushed to the extreme of that last stage, he observes, under the influence of a world which no longer recognized the value of human life and human dignity, which had robbed man of his will and made him an object to be exterminated, under this influence, the personal ego finally suffered a loss of values. If the man in the camp did not struggle against this in a last effort to save his self-respect, he lost the feeling of being an individual, a being with a mind, with inner freedom and personal value. He thought of himself as only a part of an enormous mass of people. His existence descended to the level of animal life. And here I want to kind of pause and invite you to think about overexposure to media and especially negative stories, stories that are about violence or destruction or harm. Because I think we have to be really careful about what we bring into our minds and hearts. And while sometimes we may need to know, depending on what situation of life we're in, there may be certain things we need to follow, whether it's for our prayerful intercession, whether it's for our voting, whether it's for our the actions we take. If we're overexposed to images of suffering and violence, I think eventually we will go this three-stage path, where at first we're just recoil from it. We can come to the place where we feel apathetic, that what can I do? You feel utterly helpless for it. And you may even lose those values. It's very interesting if you ever read the literary works of St. John Paul II before he was writing as a theologian and ethicist. He, as a young priest, he wrote poetry and plays. And one of my favorite is a not well-known work. He wrote a play called The Radiation of Fatherhood. And in the play, he's exploring what human freedom actually is. But he has a man named Adam, who's a worker in a factory. And Adam he works in the factory, he just feels like a cog in the machine. He's literally like he has one part of a job on an assembly line, and he does the same thing every day. He's always with a huge crowd of workers. He leaves work when the bell rings with all these people, and he steps out, and one day he's in the middle of this enormous crowd of people. And he feels so alone, even though he's surrounded by people. And he has this kind of moment of awakening where he says, it was not that he was alone, but that he was closed. And what Adam, the character in Radiation of Fatherhood, has to explore is that he has thrown off divine fatherhood and human fatherhood, because he doesn't feel like he can ever live up to what God would want him to be as a human, and he doesn't ever feel like he can be a human that can engage in other ways. So he's literally sealed himself off from others to protect his freedom, and in failing to engage his freedom in love, he has actually imprisoned himself. So it's very interesting. These themes, I think, come across in so many works. But returning to Viktor Frankl, he concluded that the human person is not merely the product of many conditional and environmental factors, whether biological, psychological, or sociological. He testifies, everything can be taken from man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. He calls this the last human freedom, to choose your attitude. You may lose all your external freedoms, but you still choose your own attitude. And he says it is this spiritual freedom that cannot be taken away that makes life meaningful and purposeful. I think that's why we're so inspired when we come across anyone who has a profound obstacle in life and still has joy and still has peace. And you've, I hope, met people like this. You know, you don't have to go away to a camp to see this, right? You can meet people who really face tremendous challenges and keep that spiritual freedom of how they respond. And it doesn't mean that all life has to be challenged, right? So while extraordinary pain and suffering can challenge our view of the meaning of life, we also witness how suffering can paradoxically awaken us to life's meaning. Have we not all witnessed at a moment, say, of a natural disaster, or of a diagnosis of a serious illness in someone's life, or some kind of a situation of emergency that draws forth heroic love, service, and sacrifice on people's parts? It's very interesting. It can draw us out of apathy immediately when suddenly there is a serious need around us. And I invite you to ponder this. I want to give you here just one little short story. When I taught high school, I had a student in my classroom. Now, when you teach high school, you see the same people every day. So I had this young woman in my classroom every day amidst a sea of 17 and 18-year-olds, and she just stood out. Every day when she came into my classroom, I thought, what is it about her? She was generous. She was joyful, kind of quiet. But I never, in the full year of teaching her, heard her complain. I never saw her exclude anyone. in any situation. I never heard her say anything unkind to or about anyone. Now, to go a full year and not hear that at all, not experience that at all, I was like, what is it about her? So we were coming towards the end of an academic year, and we were having a school retreat. And we had students who would give testimonials at the retreat, and I invited her to give a testimonial of whatever she chose to speak about her faith. And she was nervous about it, but she said, Sister, can I practice it? And I said, of course. And she invited some of her friends, and I went, and she invited me to go to her practice run of this. And she opened this little talk with this long list of very technical chemical names. I was very confused that this was an unusual way to start a testimonial. After she finished the list, she said, this is the names of the medications that I've taken every day since I was a very small child that keep me alive. I didn't know, even though I had taught her all year, that she had a very serious illness and that she was diagnosed by the doctors to never live beyond her infancy. And then she lived into childhood. And then she got into her middle years. And then she was in high school. And I received this beautiful young woman as a senior in high school. And what I saw before me, her mother described to me one day. She said, Sister, when she was a little tiny child, we took her to all the most famous sites of miracles in the world. We took her to pray at Lourdes, to pray at Fatima, to pray at Medjugorje, and we begged God to heal her. And her disease never went away. And yet, she's outlived every doctor's prognosis. This is the miracle. And she said, but you know what? She lives the truth that is true for all of us, but she knows it. It's true for all of us that every day is a gift. It's true for all of us that every day is a miracle. It's true for all of us that we don't know if we have one more after today and that we want to live this one well. But for her, it was never forgettable. Do you know, I taught her years ago, and I saw her mother a few years ago at an event in our diocese. And I almost didn't want to ask her because I was afraid that she had passed, you know, because she wasn't supposed to live past childhood. And her mother, and I just said, how are you, to her mother? And she said, I'm doing well. And she said, you know, my daughter is married and has a daughter now. She lived past, and she said, you know, Sister, she just lives every day for that day. She still has to have all the medication. Because the doctor said to her, if the disease doesn't kill you, the medicine will. And it has not. You know, and that teaching her was one of the greatest gifts of my life. So it's interesting that suffering doesn't have to crush the meaning out of life. Sometimes suffering is what can awaken you to the meaning of life. Okay? So for some of us, real though our sufferings may be, the obstacle to fullness of life might be a bit more hidden and a bit more subtle. We kind of know we're going to wrestle with those big questions when we're going through something hard, right? In his book, Life is Worth Living, the late Archbishop Fulton Sheen addresses a more widespread and perhaps even epidemic impediment to fullness of life in the current world, which is that of fatigue. I think few of us would deny that most of us are tired most of the time, and especially the young who are supposed to have the most energy of all. All right, so what is up with that? Well, bodily fatigue is a real problem and one that we can actually address by a little more balance in life. A deeper problem lies in mental fatigue, a kind of tiredness of spirit. So if the problem is physical fatigue, you know what to do with that, right? You know, this is a true story. When I was a young sister, I have a naturally kind of boisterous personality, but there was a stage where I was like not enjoying anything. And I didn't want to get out of bed. I didn't want to go to school. And this is totally not me. And I didn't enjoy my time in community and prayers. And I remember thinking, I think I need to see a doctor. And I went to my superior, the sister in charge, and I said, I have all these things going on. And I said, I don't know what to do. I feel horrible. I don't like anything. I don't enjoy life. And she said, we'll send you a doctor if we need to, but let's start here. Will you get 8 hours of sleep for an entire week every night and come back and tell me what's going on? And I was like, that's what you want me to do? It's kind of like go plunge in the Jordan and your leprosy will be healed. I was like, that's all you want me to do? And I was like, okay. So I did it. You wouldn't believe what your life would look like if you got 8 hours of sleep every night for a full week. I came back and I was like, I feel fine. I enjoy everything again. And I was like, so if it's just physical fatigue, try the 1 week sleep prescription and just see what happens. Okay. Because actually for most of us, that's hard to do. I mean, do you get 8 hours of sleep every night? I'm not asking you to raise your hands. But anyway, it's worth trying if you're just experiencing physical. However, I think this tiredness of spirit is a whole other kind of issue. Archbishop Sheen attributes this mental fatigue to two opposite root causes. He says one of the causes is having no goal or direction in life, feeling totally aimless. And the other is having too many goals. By the way, if you've ever heard of the capital sin or vice of acedia, this is a prime mark of that. You know, when we look at a list of the seven deadly sins, what's often translated as sloth, okay, is actually in the original acedia, okay? And over the history of time, it got translated as just kind of like almost laziness, and that's not what it is, actually. Sloth is actually a sadness at the energy or the investment it takes to primarily to do the things of God. So like, you don't want to put forth the effort to follow God, to pray, et cetera. But it's not even just the spiritual life, though. It's like not wanting to invest yourself. I actually think it's epidemic in the modern world. Because we live in a time of so many things are so easy. You know, in a time when people had to work hard just to have food on the table, people had a different approach to the world, okay? We have everything kind of handed to us, and I think it makes it hard for us to commit to things that you actually have to work for. And think about what you have to work for. Relationships, to do things well, to craft, you know, to learn, not just to cut and paste something that went from no one's brain into no one's brain will be graded by AI and out to no one's brain, okay? Like, what in the world? That's utterly useless, okay? But to really learn, you have to actually engage. You have to think. You have to work, okay? So let's look at these having no goals, having too many. He associates the first, the lack of a goal, with having no philosophy of life. Like, you don't even believe life means anything. So you're just kind of like going moment by moment, but for no reason. He rather humorously writes this. This is Fulton Sheen. We would not keep a new gadget in the house for 10 minutes without discovering its purpose. And yet we will live with ourselves for 10, 30, 60 years and not know why we're here or where we're going. Right? We don't keep things that we don't even know what we're supposed to do with them around. But we can avoid this question of what we're even living for kind of a while. If we see no purpose in living, we lose the energy to pursuing our goals. As university students, I think this is evident daily. We all only have so much time and so much energy, right? And we have the energy to pursue things that we see are serving a greater goal we have. So if we have a class that's actually helping us learn something we want to learn, we go to it. If there's an activity that we actually think will enrich us, that will actually change something for our lives, we do it, right? But if we see that something is kind of pointless, I mean, I remember once going to a class with one of my friends. I went to a very small university where, like, in my undergrad before I became a sister, where, like, the class, everybody knew if you were there and everybody knew if you were prepared because you were always talking and it was small groups, right? But I remember going to this lecture hall with one of my friends at another university, and it was this undergrad biology class where there were hundreds of people in this huge lecture hall. And there was somebody down there you could barely see presenting all these like slides that they got emailed to them anyway, right? And I said to oh, do I have to ask your professor if I can come sit in on the lecture? And she's like, they have no clue who's in the room. And I said, do you even go to the lectures usually? And she said, not always, because you get the slides, like you can read it yourself. They didn't take any question and answer. Like, it was completely like an exercise in futility, right? And I was like, I would hate that. Like, I've always taught in small schools and I love it because I know my students, I know whether they're there or not, they know whether I'm there. I'm always prepared. I always expect them to be prepared. And I love to engage in ideas. And I'm like, why would we waste time being together if we're not going to actually do anything in the class? Like, so we all know that when we have no like kind of goal, we become kind of listless and we don't really engage. If you're Saint newly canonized, Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati, a young Italian who dedicated his very short life to deep friendships, committed prayer, and tireless work for social justice, is a model of life to the full. And he said this on this topic of finding meaning: to live without faith, without a patrimony to defend, without a steady struggle for truth, that is not living but existing. Fulton Sheen connects the loss of a sense of meaning to the denial that we even have freedom, a kind of practical fatalism. If some thinkers are right and we're really just economically determined, or other thinkers might say we're biologically determined, you're just your genes, you're just your DNA, then we really have no true freedom. So why would we invest energy in living a life that's determined by factors outside of us? As Archbishop Sheen wisely observes, give students a target in life, a real goal, and let them exercise their freedom toward that goal, and they will not suffer from the boredom of life. I find, having worked my whole life with young people, whether it's young teens or young adults, that when you believe in them, and when you believe they have ideas that need to be listened to, and when you believe that they have the energy to put themselves into projects that have meaning, they will not be listless and apathetic. Okay. The second problem leading to mental fatigue is having too many goals. This is the dilemma of those whose view of the meaning of life shifts with every book they read, every lecture they hear, every wave of ideology that captures the popular attention. If a person sets out on a journey but continually changes the destination, he or she never reaches the goal and becomes exhausted in the process, right? Have you ever been hung out with somebody who's like that, like who cannot figure out what to do, so they just try to do everything and they do nothing, okay? It's not by keeping all options indefinitely open that we find meaning in life, but rather committing to a goal in order to reach it. And this is another one of those myths of our culture, that freedom is just keep every option open. But actually, if you commit to nothing, you're not going to experience the enjoyment of what you committed to. You have to actually choose. This is true of relationships, friendships, work, study. We can't do all things equally well all the time. To find meaning in life, we actually have to go deep. And in order to go deep, you have to commit. Okay? The person who sets out to master all fields actually masters none. And it's a myth that we can have it all, and consequently a deep error about life to the full, that it means an infinite variety of experiences and options with a commitment to none. If you want to experience a meaningful relationship, a meaningful friendship, a meaningful career path, you have to at some stage commit. You know, and again, I kind of am the product of this culture too. I remember I was teaching a high schooler who was getting burnt out because she had all these activities and she couldn't get to them all and still kind of get everything done. And I said, well, why don't you just drop a few? And she said, because my parents said, if you commit to something, you need to finish it. And I said, your parents are right. Follow them, ignore what I just said. Because they're actually right. But next semester or next academic year, rethink it when you're making your new commitments. In Life is Worth Living, Fulton Sheen proposes a threefold plan for overcoming fatigue, which he expresses first as having a master idea, second, strengthening the will, and third, having recourse to outside power. I'm going to explain what he means by each of these. First, have a master idea. By having a master idea, he means have a philosophy of life, a sense of your goal and the means that you need to achieve it. When we are aware that there is a goal to our lives, we can pursue it with hope, with energy. Our belief about where we come from, who we are, where we're going, ultimately shapes our actions and our attitudes. If we think that we just came about by some random evolutionary process, we're just determined by outside factors, that life is just a bleak struggle for survival, that's going to be pretty miserable. But if, on the other hand, we recognize that we were actually created by a personal God who actually, this is a mind-blowing thought if you've never done this in your head, the creator of the entire universe, the one who is so amazingly powerful and creative that he made, like, these crazy sea creatures we're only now finding in marine biology, right? Who set the planets in motion. Like this, who made maybe not even just a universe, maybe even a multiverse. The author of quantum physics, okay? One time, only once, had an idea that was so amazing that he fell in love with it. And he said, it has to be. And it was you. Because you can't exist apart from his actual decision to create you. There's absolutely, no matter how biologically a person came to be in this world, no matter what circumstances, positive or negative, that was in, the human soul, it's not like there's a bank of souls that were just created all at once. At the moment of conception, a unique individual soul is created by the maker of the universe, who just was like, that's such a great idea. I've got to make it. And it was you. And this is one of the reasons your life is absolutely meaningful, regardless of what capacities or incapacities you have, regardless of what experiences, regardless of your failures or your successes. Your life has this infinite value because it was infinitely loved by an infinite being. So our dignity as rational persons created in His image also points to our destiny. You were made in love and you were made for a life to the full forever with the being who called you into existence and loves you. So once we have that master plan, which is like a vision of the world, of life, like what is the meaning of life, then we need strength of will to pursue it. The second thing, strength of will. Now, I'm not saying that it's all willpower. I'm not a Pelagian, okay, I hope. But this determination to will towards the good that we were made for is a gift of God's grace, but we also have to receive it and exercise it. As St. Thomas Aquinas was asked by his sister one day in a conversation, what should I do to become a saint? And he replied with two short words, will it. And he does not mean that we will save ourselves, but what he does mean is you have to choose. He wasn't denying that there's grace, but as Father Thomas Dubé writes, it's not enough to want to be holy. We have to also choose what brings about that goal. If I want to pass my exams, I do have to study. If I want to learn something, I have to apply myself to the content. If I want to develop a deep relationship with someone, I actually have to spend time with them, listen to them, show kindness towards them, okay? Now, the third recommendation of Archbishop Sheen to have recourse to outside power is to live in humility, which is not self-hatred. To live in humility is to embrace the truth about ourselves. If we depend on the physical environment for survival, which we do, how much more do we depend on God and others for the elements of spiritual wholeness? To be humble is not to deny the gifts that we have. It's not like, oh, I'm so terrible, I can't do anything. That's not humility, okay? Humility is truthfulness. That God made you uniquely with the gifts and strengths you have, but that you need others, that you're interdependent on others so that you can live a life of love and giving. If we do not escape the fatigue of life, then we risk it falling into a state that Peter Kreeft, the philosopher, describes as man's greatest fear, that of boredom. In a book I very much encourage you to read entitled The God Who Loves You by Peter Kreeft, He points out that boredom is actually a sign of the way that we were designed. He writes this, like it or not, we come into this world with pre-designed equipment, spiritual as well as physical, and we can never alter or erase that design no matter how much we try. We're cursed with the knowledge of God. We're spoiled by the knowledge of the best, and therefore we can never be satisfied with anything less. Now he's being kind of intentionally provocative there, right? Like that it's actually like because you were made for God, you're never going to be satisfied with something less than God. So if we try to give any imperfect or passing thing the place in our souls that was reserved for God alone, the inevitable result is boredom and perhaps even contempt. If we expect anything, any experience, or even a relationship as good as those are to fulfill us entirely, we will always be disappointed. We probably see this truth most fully and expressed and well expressed, and that's why it's quoted again and again by St. Augustine when he said, O Lord, you made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. It does not mean that everything else is bad. What Augustine understood was when you love God first and foremost, all the other things you love will fall into their proper place in that love. But if you expect something less than God to fill up your soul, that person, experience, thing will always fail you. And so it's important to recognize what you were made for. Because of this God-shaped void within us, we can only live fully when we live as God lives. And since God is love, that means that we live as fully as we love. If we want to live life to the full, we have to let ourselves be loved to the full. And really, everything in creation, all the things we do love with a kind of lower love, is part of the great story of how much God loves us, but we have to open our eyes to see. Albert Einstein perceptively observed, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is though everything is a miracle. I love this. Einstein has amazing insights, not just in quantum physics. Okay, so that one is though everything's a miracle or nothing is a miracle. I really think everything is a miracle. Father Thomas Dubé, in his book, The Evidential Power of Beauty, invites us to rediscover wonder. And if I could invite you into that concept for a minute, I really think this is part of the ways that you and I can, at a very simple level, begin to live life more fully. Father Thomas Dubé says that this experience of wonder is kind of part of being a child, but that many of us, it will be squelched even by the time we're teenagers. That's a pretty strong claim. He gives 7 reasons he thinks we lose wonder between our childhood and at least our adolescence, if not our young adulthood. And actually, some of us in this room might be like, uh-oh. First, we often experience a gradual loss of the experience of beauty. Things get uglier and uglier. We see a lot of ugliness in the media, the world around us. Secondly, adults often do not spark wonder and even discourage the questions of the young. As someone who's taught most of my life, I really hope I'm not squelching the wonder of my students. And this is where the next one comes in. Thirdly, education sometimes provides only the facts, but doesn't promote wonder about the facts. How many times in your life of education have you been asked to think about something, to ponder it, to ask questions about it? Fourthly, we can lose attentiveness to nature. You know, how many times do you go so busily through your day, get in your car, walk into your house, but don't even stop to look for a minute at the trees or the sky? Fifth, there can be a lack of instruction in moral beauty. And here he says, morality is not just a list of do's and don'ts. There's the lives of the saints. You know, I feel like growing up being taught the lives of the saints was such a gift. My own nieces and nephews didn't really get exposed to the lives of the saints at all. And I realized they don't have models of like a stellarly beautiful life. Like, it's really sad. Sixth, overstimulation can lead us to psychological fatigue. How many times have you, because you were tired, just mindlessly scrolled through a bunch of stuff online, but then you ended up more tired than you were when you began? Because it's not proper leisure. It doesn't properly renew you, right? Seventh, sin or unloving choices can dull our sense of beauty and even obscure it altogether. But Jesus said to his followers, unless you have the heart of a child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. It's not that we have to become childish, as we've probably heard before, but we need to be childlike. And one of the ways we maintain that childlike disposition is wonder, the capacity to stand in awe before mystery. I love the mystery of the human person. When I teach, especially when I taught high school, because they'd all take exams at the same time in this one big room, it's kind of strange, but anyway, they'd all be sitting there and they'd be looking down at their paper for 2 hours. And so I would be just look at each one and kind of ponder the beauty. I would kind of stand in awe and I would pray for each one separately. And I would start there just by marveling at the goodness of the way God made that individual, because by then I taught them long enough. So I really knew like the gift of each of them. I find the mystery of the human person one of the most beautiful things to ponder. That you can ponder anything, the goodness in creation, the goodness in the world around us. If we approach nature only as a problem to be solved rather than a gift to be received, we lose our wonder and gratitude, and the love song of creation can be silenced in our hearts. So I invite you to say, are you surviving or thriving? Do you hunger for life to the full, the gift that Christ came to give you? I want to offer you a few hopefully helpful suggestions if you feel like you might be a little bit more surviving than thriving. And this is, I'm almost finished. Firstly, if you are suffering and that's an obstacle to your thriving, know that you're not alone. And that's not just a nice thought. God does not observe our pain from a distance. Here we are in the brink of Holy Week, right? He enters it. He enters it. He became man to embrace our crosses. He carries your cross with you just as really as Simon walked with him on that road so long ago. He showed us that love robs suffering of its meaninglessness. Secondly, I invite you to renew your desire to find truth, beauty, and goodness. Seriously, do something every day, even if it's just for a few minutes, that's just to find something true, good, or beautiful. A little thing you want to read, a beautiful artwork. Right now I have a art gallery's like art piece a day that it's just one of those like tear off calendar pages, but I love it because I love art. And so I just look at like a beautiful masterwork of art each day. Music, something truly beautiful that inspires you. Thirdly, seek deeply to know the true purpose of life and commit yourself to a relationship or experience that helps you become the person that you were created to be. Fourthly, discover God's love for you in prayer every day. Do not let a single day go by without prayer, even if it's just a few minutes. Read the story of the Bible and see yourself in it. Read the love story that is your own life. See how God is at work in it. Never underestimate the fullness of life that you receive in the bread of life, the Eucharist. Jesus said, "I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever, and the bread that I will give is my flesh for the life of the world." Take him at his word. That is fullness of life, objectively. You know? Beautiful, you're preparing for your to receive him from the Eucharist. Even for those who aren't already receiving him, to go into his presence in a chapel, even those who do not even fully know yet, entering into the presence of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament can actually transform us. Okay. Next, seek to give the love you receive. Love others the way Christ loves, and do not wait for another day. This is one of the most important things I can say to you, so listen. We often wait to live a very generous, loving life for something to come. When I graduate, then I'll be able to love and serve other people. You know, when I find my vocational path, then I'll be able to love and serve other people. When I make my life commitment, then I'll be able to love and serve other people. When we have our first child, then I'll be able to love and serve other people. When my kids are gone, then I'll be able to love and serve. We could wait our whole lives. And if you have never read the autobiography or any of the writings of Cardinal Francis Xavier Vantuan, Cardinal Vantuan was a bishop in Vietnam during the time when the communists took over in Vietnam. Bishop Vantuan was a dynamic spiritual leader. He was running all kinds of, it's kind of like the Catholic Student Center here on campus. He was running all kinds of great ministries in his diocese. People were coming into the church by numbers because of the dynamism of this man. And then one day, he got arrested, imprisoned. He was in prison for 13 years. 9 of the 13 years were in solitary confinement. He was imprisoned in his own city. He could hear his cathedral bells ringing. And he was like, "Lord, I was running Bible studies. I was running faith formation. I was like bringing people into the church. I was like, why did you let this happen to me?" And the first thing he heard God say in that experience was, "Francis, did you choose me or my works?" That was the beginning of his like big change. He was like, "God, I chose you, not your works." But then the second conversion is directly relevant to all of us, I think. He was kind of there like, why am I here? The only people he saw during his years, 9 years of solitary confinement, were the guards who were atheist communists who just brought him his meal. And he heard God say to him, "Don't wait. Today, love whoever I send you." And Francis was like, "I'm in solitary confinement." And he found himself saying, like, when I'm out of here, I'll do great things for God. When? And then he's like, "No." And Francis Xavier Vantuan, in his prison cell, said, "I will not wait. Today I will love whoever God sends me." And guess who he was sent? Atheist communist guards. And he thought, they don't want to learn about Jesus, and I'm a Catholic bishop. What am I supposed to be doing for them? And he was like, they wanted to learn English. So he started teaching them English. Little words here and little words there. And then they started to like him because they were like, he sees us and he's trying to help us. And then because they kind of started liking him, they started smuggling things in for him. Little bottles that said they were stomach medicine. It was wine. He would put a drop in his hand and he would say the mass by memory, consecrating in the chalice of his hand, the drops of wine, right? And then they would bring in fish wrapped in newspaper so he could learn things about the outside world. And then he started writing pastoral, he learned if he turned the newspaper to the side, he could start writing pastoral letters to his people, the people of his diocese, and they would take it back. So you see, and his ministry of letters from prison grew and grew. He survived those years in prison. And do you know, he was brought by Pope John Paul II to preach the Lenten retreat to the Vatican staff under John Paul II. This is the man, and he was made a cardinal of the Catholic Church. Right? And he actually was named the head of the prefect. He was the prefect of the Congregation for Justice and Peace. You know? But it began with saying, I will not wait. I will love whoever God sends me today. And I promise you, if you receive God's love in prayer, even just a few minutes of quality time with God a day, and you say, I'm not going to wait, today, whoever I meet, however I'm called to love, I'm going to do it, you will find your life is very meaningful. And when you fail to love, get up. Trust in God's mercy and keep going. Run to the God who loves you, the God who comes to meet you as soon as you realize that you've turned away from him. Go frequently to confession. Trust in the power of the Spirit of God. Trust in the ministry of the church. I believe Jesus speaks to us today the same truth he spoke long ago. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father through me. Do you want life to the full? He says, I came that you might have life and have it to the full. Dare to pray. An author, Timothy Verdon, writes in a book called Art and Prayer, The Beauty of Turning to God, and this is my conclusion. Prayer changes lives. If many do not pray, it's perhaps because they're afraid to become what they are not yet, afraid to change, afraid to live, afraid to be. The saints, by contrast, are those who accept the challenge to change as God wants, to live as God lives, to be as God is. Do not be afraid. Dare to seek, and you will find the one who's already seeking you and who came that you personally might have life and have it to the full. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.